Today, finding clear air. Hello, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to another edition of our Finance and Property News with an Australian flavour. Today, I'm with property advisor and buyer's agent, Chris Curtis again, and we're going to have another look at the Sydney property market. Welcome back, Chris.
Good to be back. Thank you for the second invitation.
Well, you did quite well the first time. There was a lot of enthusiasm with regard to our earlier post, and I think people were quite interested in your perspective, looking at it, as it were, from the other side of the coin.
Yeah.
One of the things that came up in that conversation, though, was about how different is the top end of the market. And, you know, there's a little bit of a sense that generally people sort of bucket the top end into one block. You know, the CoreLogic deciles puts everything over a certain amount up in one block. But I think our sense is that maybe that's not the right way to think about it. So today, perhaps we're going to explore that in a little bit more detail.
Yeah. And also, if you go back to that first video we did, we had a brief exchange in the course of that where I said the top end, you know, the higher it is, the more they fall. I think that probably needs a bit of refinement. And I said the idea of prestige and top end is sometimes defies analysis, but a convenient cutoff point was about $2.5 million. And I'd like to sort of probably answer that question by exploring exactly where I think we should put the flag in when we talk top end. Because coincidentally, since that first video, of course, as you mentioned, CoreLogic has come out with its report, and that's leveraged a lot of headlines about all to the effect that the top end is crashing through the floor. The thing that's interesting about some of those secondary sources, as you'd no doubt know, is that nobody seems to define exactly where the actual report puts the flag in each of the 10 deciles. But so the top end, actually, if one does that and pays the fee to get the report, rather than repeating the hearsay, is it starts at $1.8 to $8 million or thereabouts. That is hardly top end. It's in fact very modest on any understanding of the top end or prestige Sydney property market, a very modest bracket, and it only goes up to about a shade over $1.9 million. So that is a very modest sort of thing. So to leverage or to derive a conclusion that the top end is falling because that particular bracket has fallen about 7.6% is inaccurate on any view of it. So the first question I think is, where do we, you know, more accurately put the flag in? Because as you rightly suggest, there's more happening at the true top end that's inconsistent with what's happening elsewhere in the Sydney property market, and that's coming through in the data and also our experience, and also experience of others on the ground anecdotally, on the selling side of things and also on the buying side of things. Anecdotally, the feeling on the ground at the moment is that $3 to $5 million is, $1 to $3 million is certainly not top end, except perhaps the very end of that scale could be relevant to that. And we'll, I think, come back and explore that. If you go from $3 to $5 million, unarguably you're getting towards the top end. There'd be those who cavil with that and say that, you know, that the top end or prestige really doesn't begin below $5 million, and then it goes up to what some people call the ultra top end, which is $10 million plus, and then, you know, they can go up to infinity or $80 million and so forth. So I think it's a more refined analysis to say that, although it almost beggars belief, that the top end is probably begins in that bracket between $3 million and $5 million, is unarguably top end prestige from $5 million through to $10 million, and I don't think there's any distinctions in that range whatsoever when defining what top end means, and then $10 million is ultra top end. So if you look at the, there's anecdotal evidence from some, in our day-to-day experience as a buyer's agent working exclusively in Sydney, that the question of finance at that end has had a bit of an impact. So you hear a lot of people saying a buyer could, this time last year or 6 months ago, afford something for $3 million now. The credit tightening that has occurred apropos of the Royal Commission and everything we've talked about before now means that buyers are $2.5 million buyer. So there is some compression in that $3 to $5 million bracket, which I think is more properly understood as moving from something that may arguably not be top end to what is unarguably top end. So there will be some adjustment at the end of that, at the beginning of that bracket, closer to $3 than $5 million, if that particular buyer, as many of them are in our experience, because that's very much a sweet spot for our business of Curtis Associates, is going to, those sort of buyers will be dependent to some extent on debt. And I think as we go further up that food chain towards the $5 million mark, that dependency in the normal course drops off. And then at $5 million, it probably doesn't become so much as a dependency as a rearrangement of a portfolio, perhaps selling down some shares, perhaps liquidating a less than desirable investment property to top up the difference if they don't want to borrow. So that's the sort of buyer that isn't a sole property in the portfolio type buyer, and if they don't want to gear the next acquisition or trade up, then they'll probably liquidate an asset or another to make up the difference. So there's plenty of equity floating around, the bottom line being that there's not that debt dependence at that level.
So, let me just come in there, because we looked at some specific postcodes, right? Yeah. So places like Vaucluse and Mossman and a few other top-end postcodes. And I actually did some analytics on those based on our core market model.
Yes.
And I can bring some colour now to your hypothesis, right, based on what you're saying there.
Yes.
And the analysis that we did chopped it up into groups again. And we found exactly what you suggested we might find, which was there is definitely something going on between, let's say, the 1 million and the 3 million area, where firstly, people's buying power has been crimped because of the changes in the underwriting standards that have come in. And so we are seeing both buying power and prices being squeezed in that zone. But as you begin to go above the 3, 4, 5, 6, and look, the sample is getting smaller, of course, because there aren't that many, just, you know, mathematically. But above that, it looks to me as though people are flying in clear air because they don't have the same debt. They have significantly more asset portfolios. And there seems to be almost no sign of any distress or mortgage stress or anything in that top-end group. So to put all of those into one group and say it's the top-end, you know, right away from 1.x all the way up, is clearly missing the point. We've actually got some very different markets going on here. The other overlay is if you then say, well, who are those people from our segmentation perspective, right? It's quite interesting, because if you go in that sort of 4, 5, 6 above, right, then you've got the exclusive professions, as you'd expect. You've also got some young affluents who are up there. And you've also got some wealthy seniors who are up there. And those three groups were pretty much the whole of the area. And if you come down, you've got a much more different and diverse mix of people. So again, it looks to me as though there is some bifurcation between the sort of the, you know, say the 1 million to 3 plus and then 3 well above plus. That's what we think to be seeing from the data, which would sort of chime with
it does. Yeah, look, it's very consistent with you know, what we're feeling on the ground. If you look at the $1 to $3 million bracket, undoubtedly a great proportion of them are going to be very dependent on debt, and they are the ones who are really feeling the pinch at the moment. And it's a pinch at various types. It's not only a pinch in terms of what they're able to borrow absolutely, which has been crimped in just dollar terms, but also the time it's taking to process those. And I think we're going to see a lot more of this as the Royal Commission trundles on and so forth, as banks try to anticipate what they might be forced to do and sort of jump before they're pushed, as it were, if only for reputation preservation purposes. You're going to find a situation which has a big impact in the auction market, for example. And there was a headline in the Fairfax media yesterday to that effect, talking about one bidder auctions becoming the norm. Well, of course, a one bidder auction is effectively like, you know,
it's not an auction.
Well, it's not an auction. You know, you're fighting a battle with your arm, you know, tied behind you.
Sure.
So, and that's because it's taking what used to say take 5 days now it takes 5 weeks. In effect, you know, that's only an example. But so the crimping there is also the speed with which buyers and vendors can actually transact, whereas before, a 3 to 4, 5 week turnaround period from first advertising a property, if it went to the open market, to the fall of the hammer, is now something which may have to be rethought. And that's an interesting sort of dynamic, because the auction process has been very much a feature of the Sydney property market, and even more so of the Melbourne property market. So there's a speed and there's a quantum aspect there, but both up to $3 million, there is no doubt that the CoreLogic report is right, and that's where the pressure is being felt. As you move further from 3 through to 5, then again, it becomes, it's all about debt. It's all about debt and the nature of the debt and the quantum of the debt and the importance of debt to the overall acquisition. And the further you get, the closer you get to 5, as I say, more likely you're going to be relying on private equity of some type or another. Then debt, therefore you're not at the mercy of your financier. So it's a tale of two cities in many respects, and arguably a tale of three cities. And I think to the groups that you mentioned in terms of the affluent seniors, the young affluents, you know, the entrepreneurs and so forth, who are occupying that more stratospheric area of $5 million plus, you've also got to talk about the upgrader as well, which is probably going to have a foot in the more than one of those other two groups. But that's somebody who may have quit the market or can organise their portfolio in a certain way to who sees this as a great buying opportunity. And there are several people now sort of thinking that, you know, this is not a bad time. While the herd is looking to the east, look to the west and do something counter-cyclical. The upsizers, the up-traders who may have quit the market are in a very good position to actually make a marginally more significant improvement to their lifestyle or to their investment portfolio for a marginally less cost in terms of upscaling. They're the sort of people too that are occupying that $3+ million bracket. So when you combine all of those people, and they all have one thing in common compared to the cohort in the $1 to $3 million bracket, and that is less debt. Mm. When you aggregate those in the Sydney property market, you're looking at a fairly strong phalanx of buyers. Of course, there won't be the volume, the turnover. But oddly enough, it'll be interesting to see what the final statistics and the best statistics are going to be, the actual transfers that are recorded, and they take 6 to 12 weeks to come out, which is more the pity. Mm. But it'll be very interesting to see just what the volumes are like between 1 to 3 million, for example, as a group, compared to 3 to 10 million or even 3 to 5 million. My expectation is that there will be a compression between those two groups in this phase that we're in now, rather compared to, say, a year ago or 2 years ago. So I think volumes are down generally, turnover is down generally, but I think marginally and relatively speaking, the higher cohort from 3 million onwards will probably be trading more than those below because of debt.
So I guess the question then is, if that activity continues in the clear out at the top of the market, you know, does that have any significant impact on the broader market, or is it really a completely different market with a complete set of different set of dynamics and actually largely irrelevant to the broader market where there are many more transactions and large price properties? I mean, is there a connection or not, do you think?
Look, we're great believers in saying, you know, it's all about the submarkets and the interaction between the two submarkets. So it's an interesting question that over time, I think there is probably a connection between them, but on the day-to-day, they are largely completely separate from each other. There's no such thing as a broad market that has its parts that are being influenced in the same way as each other. And I think no more telling is it than the market that we're in now, because of a fairly, we're in a situation where we've got to a point where it's been a lot, perhaps in the eyes of some, too little but too late. So we've actually had a period of time where the credit tap has been on for a great period of time, and that's infected the entire market. So that's a situation where I think the answer to your question is, Martin, that if you're talking about a submarket that all of the protagonists in which are influenced in the same way as another submarket, so for example debt, and if you go back to 2007, I think you had a situation where it was sensible to talk about a broader market coming out of, say, two submarkets, for example, 1 million to 3 million, 3 million plus, because debt was a common element in the 2007 spike. in a way that it isn't now in one of those markets, but it is still important to the lower end or that smaller submarket or the cheaper submarket. So if they have something in common, I think then that you can see implications of one submarket for another. But the moment you sever that commonality, then I think you're in a situation where they're essentially two separate markets. And that's what I think is going to be happening now, not a great deal of crossover between them. And the difference between now and 10 years later is there has been accumulated an enormous amount of cash looking for a home. Post-GFC, a lot of people have done very, very well out of it, and simply with the yield compression that's occurred generally in equities and bonds, they really have nowhere to park that money. And this is not just domestic capital, it's onshore capital as well, and not just Chinese capital. You're going to have a situation where that separation between submarkets will continue, in my view.
So the interesting thing there is that we talk about debt and, you know, the fact that debt is definitely being rationed.
Yeah.
And the hurdles are a lot higher. I mean, CBA announced that they've now got this 9 different categories.
Yeah, or 11 or something.
It's a huge number, right?
Yeah,
and basically you need to know how much you're spending on communications and childcare, you know.
Yeah.
Now, my theory on that is that's all to do with protecting themselves, because effectively if they can get the buyer ultimately to say... the borrower to say, ultimately, I've signed off on this, so therefore my expenses are right. That means they're no longer under an obligation with regard to not a suitable lending, because effectively they can turn around and say, well, that's what they told us.
Absolutely, no doubt about that.
So that's the quick pass across to the borrower saying it's your liability now, mate. And that's true via brokers or third party. Now, of course, at the top end, the demand for debt and the way that debt is actually negotiated is completely different, isn't it?
Look, I think it is, and if you know, you're talking about sophisticated investors, you have a different duty owed, and you know, in the banking fraternity, speaking as a former barrister, acted a lot for banks and then, you know, worked for one, but have no particular allegiance one way or the other. There's a lot of people say, well, nobody's forcing you to borrow this money. You know, you have a duty yourself. If you can't afford to pay for it, you shouldn't tell fibs to the bank to get the money and hope it all goes well, or better still, the property market continues an ever upwards trajectory, and therefore your lie loan, if it be that, will never be detected. You know, there's some who have very little sympathy for that, but I do agree with you that I think, and again speaking as a former barrister, that there's a little bit of common sense, I would imagine, amongst the banks in saying let's shift the onus back onto the borrower, because it shifts the potentially the liability from us. So it's not just all about PR. I think it's probably some forensics in that as well. And that makes perfect sense, you know, from their point of view, if you see it that way.
Well, it does from a legal perspective, because it actually gets them out of their current not unsuitable hole, right? I suppose there's a broader question, though. Does that mean they're still going to be able to lend, right? Because they've shifted the legal burden.
Yep.
So that could be a strategy that actually allows them to continue to lend perhaps more than they might have previously.
You know, the latest statistics, you know, coming out from the ABS, that we are slightly intrigued by the fact that there's a mismatch between those statistics. I mean, there's still a dead cat bounce in terms of owner-occupiers and investor finance occurring, which is very different to what we're feeling on the ground and other data of the type that you're referring to, where we've got increased stress and so forth. So somehow there's still money being advanced, but you then have situations where you have one bidder at an auction, or people needing much more time to actually settle the purchase. And the point that I was making in our first video too about the valuation profession running scared, that I can think of numerous anecdotes that we've been involved with since the 11th of June when we last spoke, where this is happening across town. And there's all sorts of explanations given for this. But that's having a major bearing, because if you don't know that, you know, what the final valuation is going to come in, particularly in an auction situation, which after all only constitutes about 25% of all transactions in New South Wales, but it's still a significant slab. A lot of people tend to forget that, you know, you are, as the buyer, assuming the valuation risk in an auction situation in the same way as you would if you had a Section 66W certificate in a private treaty negotiation. And until now, and in fact for as long as I've been in the world of property advising and buyer's agency, that's been something that people have done with complete comfort and relaxation in many senses, never thinking that their valuer wouldn't put a figure lower on it than the figure that the market took it to on that day. Now that reality is being upended, and that itself is a dynamic, I think, that will operate significantly in that $1 to $3 million bracket if it continues. And if valuers run scared and come up with valuations that are different to those thrown up by the market itself, whatever the reason, then I think that's going to be a game changer. And certainly insofar as those 25% are concerned.
So there's two interesting points there. First is that since your first video, I've had a number of people come back to me and said, we've been bitten on the bum by the fact that our value got dropped during the process.
Yes.
And that means we couldn't complete.
Yeah.
In some cases, they actually lost some of the deposit because they couldn't actually get to carry it through. So it's real.
Yeah, definitely.
And the other thing is, I agree with you. I'm still scratching my head. How can it be that credit is growing at annualized 6% even now? Yet with all the stuff that we're seeing from the data and from what's going on now, I think part of it is there's a lot of refinancing still happening.
But even if you take the refinancing out, it's still growing.
I know, I was going to say exactly that. Right. So you strip it back and think, well, hang on a moment.
Yeah.
Somebody's still lending more money.
Yeah.
And it's not churning existing loans. It's got to be new loans.
Yeah.
So somebody is still out there, and it's enough to support the bank's book growth. And of course, all the banks are desperate to continue to grow their loan books, so they're not complaining. And Wayne Byers list last week said 8% is a healthy growth rate. Well, I might be a bit aggressive, but it's really interesting. So whether we'll see the data, you know, smoothing out and beginning to slide again, or whether this is actually something else going on that we don't quite understand yet, I think it's a really interesting and open question. And I haven't got any answers yet. My surveys are telling me people are cramped. They're actually finding it difficult to get loans. They're finding the valuations are being squeezed. There's a lot of property on the market now. All of those factors would suggest we should be seeing credit much lower. If it really is still growing at 6%, my own view is they've got to do some further tightening, because 6% is still 3 times annual income growth. And that's nuts when we've got the ratio so high.
The other thing too is the non-bank financial lender. We're getting all sorts of anecdotes about very generous terms. Yes, sure, with high interest rates, but particularly, you know, from the developers as well, they're struggling to get sources of finance from banks. It's extremely difficult. But private syndicates, non-bank financial lenders and so forth, I mean, it's growing. There's hardly any doubt about that. So that's another source of credit coming into the marketplace, in addition to this 6% annualized growth through the deposit-taking institutions. I'm still of the opinion, based on what we're experiencing day-to-day, is that the $4 million, three plus up to the $5 million is essentially self-funded people coming from the class of buyers that we've talked about. There are strange things going on in the market, and I think the market's going to look quite different 12 months from now to the market that we even see today. And I think it's going to be one where there will have been some fairly significant corrections up to $3 million, far less significant correction from $3 million upwards, and perhaps some standout results too for some happy vendors in that period of time. And I think a significantly fewer number of auctions if it continues this way. And that's all before we know what the final report, and whenever that final report might be published, and moot point here is whether or not the Royal Commission will extend its period of sitting, but Cormann has indicated that if they ask, they will get that time. So we may not be out of the woods even this time next year, but I think it's going to be a different landscape.
So my theory is they may not actually make huge recommendations to change the law, because a lot of the issues that they flushed out were to do with people not keeping the rules, right? Either bending them or absolutely breaking them. And this is more about implementation of those rules. So you could almost say the responsible lending stuff actually exists already, and just people went around it.
Yeah.
In which case, the recent changes that we've seen to the way that underwriting standards have been tightened, or at least in a quasi way that we discussed earlier, may be sufficient. I don't know. So who knows? But I'm really interested in this, because I know that there are some suburbs where prices have dropped up to 20% down in the lower end of the market. Not right down the bottom, So, you know, if I'm looking at sort of 300,000 to 500,000, there's quite a lot of growth there at the bottom, but it's above that. So it's about 500,000 up to, you know, 1 and a bit million in the main Sydney markets. That's where the weakness seems to be at the moment. And so that tells me, again, it goes back to your earlier point, granularity is king here. You actually have to get granular. You have to actually go into those individual areas and understand the different dynamics, because averaging across Sydney is just going to, you know, not be right.
It's meaningless.
Yeah, it's going to give you an indication. That's,
you're talking about different asset classes too. I mean, it's probably no surprise that, and we don't sort of dwell too often in that bracket, certainly not 500,000, but say up to 1.5 million, you're going to have a good slab of units that are coming on stream that are, you know, where supply presently in the cycle is exceeding demand regardless of what people say. And, you know, all the data is consistent with that. It doesn't suit the narrative for some people to, you know, it's contrary to the idea that we must keep building. That's a different question altogether. But I think you're going to have quite substantial differences in that part of the market, for example, compared to the $4 million plus part of the market. So they're simply not influenced by the same factors as each other. And there's different imperatives at work. And then, you know, you've got a situation where there's been a withdrawal of foreign and particularly Chinese finance in that lower bracket, which whereas before that sort of asset was a prime destination for that, with everything that's occurred in China and everything that we've done onshore here to repel that buyer. Whereas, however, there's, you know, the Knight Frank report that came out recently in relation to millionaires coming into to Australia, and that again requires some real granularity in terms of analysis, because the visas, the two, you know, turbocharging visas, and there's lots of controversy about those, exclude real estate from, you know, from the special visa, for example, the $5 million at once. Originally, you could include real estate in that $5 million, but not for some time. So you have a situation where, nevertheless, people are onshore. They're effectively buying citizenship by putting money into various assets in Australia. The secondary effect of that surely has to be that some of that foreign capital is going to feed its way into onshore real estate, both residential and commercial, by some mechanism or another. And I'm not suggesting illicit. But once that capital is closer to the shores of to Australia, then I think you're going to see the local real estate market benefit, and they are right now. So I think part of what is propping up that $3+ million bracket is going to be some onshore money, perhaps not coming in through the direct channels that we're used to, but coming through indirectly, because Sydney is, you know, relative to other cities, and we talk about it being very expensive, it's highly indebted, but relative to, you know, Monaco or Hong Kong, you know, on a rate per square metre basis, we're about middle of the range of developed countries. When you look at Singapore and various other destinations for foreign capital, we are therefore, with all else, with our attributes, our proximity to China, we're 2 hours time difference with China. It's a very attractive destination. If you're looking for, you know, parking offshore funds, you'll find a way. So I think that's probably propping up the market at that end of the market in some respects as well. So it's this constant quest for the data that faithfully answers these questions, because there are still anomalies in the marketplace that only time will supply the answer.
Chris Curtis, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome. Likewise, Martin. Thank you.
So there you go. Some interesting observations there from Chris, which basically just underscores the fact that this is not a single market that we're looking at across the country or indeed in and around Sydney. It'll be interesting to see how this all plays out over the next few months. If you found this presentation useful, do consider making a contribution by our Patreon channel. The link is just up there. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Thanks for listening. And I'll talk to you again next time.